Welcome to Building the Future, Freedom, Prosperity, and Foreign Policy, a podcast series focused on updating the United States' soft power playbook to meet the hopes and aspirations of developing countries because it's in America's interest to do so. I'm Dan Rundy, Senior Vice President at CSIS. There are a lot of global challenges out there, so let's get started. So hello and welcome back to another episode of Building the Future with Dan Rundy. Today I'm joined by Jacob Heilbrunn. He's the author of the new book, America Last, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. Jacob Heilbrunn is currently serving as a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. He's also, more importantly, more interestingly, the editor of The National Interest, a very important foreign policy magazine established in 1985. I read it and I've contributed to it. I take it very seriously. It's an important platform. He began his career as an assistant editor at the magazine, where the first issue he worked on featured Francis Fukuyama's The End of History essay. Wow. And later he served as a senior editor at the New Republic and worked as an editorial writer for the LA Times. His writings have been published in several publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Foreign Affairs, and Reuters. He also received the George F. Kennan Award in 2007 for his commentary on German-American relations. In 2008, his book called They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, was published by Doubleday and was named one of the 100 notable books of the year by the New York Times. So I'm podcasting Jacob today to discuss his new book, America Last, The Right Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. Frank Luntz says, you got to repeat the title 7 times for people to remember it. So I'm going to try and say it 7 times, Jacob, to make sure people go out and get it and read it. So thanks for joining us. So Jacob, let me just start with the obvious question I always ask people, like, why did you write this book?
I have long been fascinated by the American conservative movement. And this book is the twin of the first one on the neoconservatives. This is another wing of the Republican Party that has existed for at least a century and what we would refer to as the old right today. And in my book, I trace the history and the emergence of the old right after World War I.
I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican. I read Matthew Continetti's book. I think it's The Right, I think is what it's called. And I think this is an interesting adjunct book to your book, The America Last. There was stuff in here I knew nothing about and I thought was really quite interesting. I want you to start with the fascination by a subset of folks that might be called in the old right who were fascinated by Kaiser Wilhelm II. I'd not given much thought to Kaiser Wilhelm II, and that is, I think, reflects some of my own ignorance. But also when I read the chapter, I was quite shocked by what I read. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I delved back into the controversies surrounding American entry into World War I. And there was a lot of opposition to it, both on the left and the right in America. And that opposition was not necessarily illegitimate. There were good grounds to think that the United States should not enter what was essentially a European civil war, if you like. However, as I looked at the origins of this conservative movement, it became clear to me that some of the opposition was rooted not in, let's say, realistic worries about American power, but more about an admiration for Prussian autocracy and a contempt for American democracy. And these arguments sounded familiar to me from today. And I began to conclude in looking at figures like H.L. Mencken, who was the most famous journalist of his era, and another German-American, George Sylvester Viereck, who functioned as an agent of the German government in both World War I and in World War II. And they propagated the argument, which took off in the 1920s, that America should not enter World War I and that the Western democracies were, in fact, the villains who had surrounded and encircled Prussia and Wilhelmine Germany, and that, in fact, the democracies are the culprits, and that democracy is not something that you should support. And this argument took off in the 1920s. We see people like Albert J. Nock, who is a mentor to William F. Buckley Jr., are writing a book after World War I called The Myth of the Guilty Nation. So the whole drive was to portray Germany as a beleaguered innocent and to tear down America and the American democracy. And that started to take off in the 1920s. And it fuses with the rise of the eugenics movement in the 1920s, when you had, I focus on another figure named Lothrop Stoddard, who wrote a famous book called The Rising Tide of Color, which was published in 1920. And essentially, he originates the Great Replacement Theory. He argues that the United States and the Western democracies had committed race suicide in World War I, that the best white men had died, and that the West was now menaced by an influx from Asia and Africa. Now, Stoddard was not a marginal figure. The book was not only a bestseller, but he testified before Congress in 1924, and an extremely restrictive immigration act, which the Los Angeles Times called a victory for Nordic supremacy, was passed. So all the seeds were set then for the 1930s, the rise of the America First movement. And in my book, not to drone on here too long, I trace the admiration for Mussolini and Adolf Hitler that existed among elements of the American right.
Yeah, this admiration for Kaiser Wilhelm, Adolf Hitler, and Mussolini were all shocking to me and stuff I didn't know about. Let's talk about this person, Viereck. I'd not heard about him before. I would not be surprised if his actions led to the creation of the Foreign Agent Registration Act. I think that's probably the case, right? Because he clearly was a foreign agent, an unregistered foreign agent for, I don't know, Nazi Germany, and maybe for Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany. Who is this person? Because I'm not going to say he's lost to history, but he's not a household name. But I suspect that at the time, he was quite famous. He was a very well-known figure from the 20s through at least the 1950s. I don't know how to describe him, but he was sort of a controversial cultural figure, if I can describe him that way.
He was an entrepreneur of disinformation, both in World War I and World War II. And in World War I, you know, he worked closely with the German embassy and he had secret documents. He was followed by the Secret Service. He got into trouble, but he managed to wiggle out in World War I. But it was World War II where he really got into hot water because he was, in fact, imprisoned as a Nazi agent for several years during World War II. And he conducted a massive disinformation campaign through the U.S. Congress. I mean, he had senators like Ernest Lundeen. He had Hamilton Fish, who was a congressman. And what he did was he set up a front organization in Washington that posed as a think tank, but in fact used the franking privilege of Congress to disseminate pro-Nazi literature throughout the United States to millions of people. He was a key figure, not the only figure, but a key figure in the isolationist movement. He even wrote one of the books for another congressman called Stephen Day from Illinois, Why the America Should Not Intervene Against Nazi Germany. So a lot of the things that we see today with Russian disinformation, with this great replacement theory, have all come from the past. Plus, you add in the scorn for democracy, the worship of authoritarianism. I try to draw the parallels between the past and the present. None of the things that we hear today are new. They were all road tested back in the 1920s, 30s.
Talk, please, about sympathy for Mussolini and sympathy for Hitler. There was sort of a strain, not just Viereck, but others. Could you talk a little bit about this and where did that come from and what was that about?
It was a mixture. Some of it was ideological. There was this woman named Elizabeth Dilling, who was known as the female Führer in Germany. She visited the Nuremberg party rallies. So did another intellectual who's known as the most prominent fascist in America named Lawrence Dennis. And there was, of course, Charles Lindbergh, who really catapulted the America First movement to mass appeal. And their arguments were not dissimilar to the arguments we hear today about Ukraine. They argued that Russia had been encircled by the United States and the other European democracy. I mean, they argued that Germany had been encircled, just as you hear today people saying that we encircled Russia, that NATO is the culprit. They also saw Hitler and Mussolini as figures who had more mettle than decadent Western democracies. Mussolini in particular was seen as a virile man. And Hitler was seen as having the key to the economic future because Nazi Germany was prospering. And there was a good deal of anti-Semitism on the American right. You also had former President Herbert Hoover travels to Berlin in 1938 in March and meets with Hitler shortly before the annexation of Austria and announces that it would be a good thing if Nazi Germany controlled Central and Eastern Europe because it will help bring order. And Hoover in 1940 at the Republican Convention announces he wanted to run for president again. He didn't get the nod, but it's in July in Philadelphia. He denounces Franklin Roosevelt and his aides for criticizing Nazi officials. So there is tremendous ferment on the American right in the 1930s that is explicitly sympathetic to Nazism. It's not that these people were isolationists. They were actually pro-fascist.
It's wild. I wanted to push a little bit on this issue of during the Cold War, I would argue we had to make difficult decisions about what kind of allies and partners we were going to have. And oftentimes we had to make decisions to support what might be described as unsavory partners. You talk about some of that. I'd like you to talk a little about, but what I wanted to get at was if we're in a second Cold War, and there are some who would argue we're in a second Cold War, I've used the term great power competition, which seems to be like a more workable term. I suspect you also lived through the first Cold War or remember it. And so I'm a little leery of using the term Cold War because I feel it's kind of a loaded term. If it at least kind of rhymes with some of the challenges of the first Cold War, this era that we're in, aren't we also going to have to make the kinds of unsavory choices that we had to make in the first Cold War and the space for supporting democracy and human rights, which I'm a big proponent of? I think we should do these things. We should stand up for these things. Aren't we going to be presented with some complex dilemmas and there'll be less space for pushing for these important values? I don't know if I'm making myself clear of the question I'm trying to get
at. No, you are. Look, this isn't confined to the Cold War. It's a perennial problem for the United States because we don't have the luxury of ordering the world as we would like it to be. So we do have to make compromises. It doesn't mean that you abandon human rights. But look, we have this dilemma with India, which we want to use as a bulwark against China. What I'm driving at in my book is not that you never make any compromises, but we're not talking about cold foreign policy realism here. We're talking about adulating these regimes. We're talking about saying that Franco's Spain is superior to the United States. We're saying that South African apartheid is a model for American race relations. These are things, all things that were in the National Review magazine and that William F. Buckley espoused. That's saying that Pinochet is a regal leader and that they figured out how to order their society and that maybe things in some ways are better off over there than they are here. And you heard the same thing from Pat Buchanan about Singapore, that Singapore was a model society than the United States, that we are the decadent ones. That's when you're running into blame America first. Blame America First was in the World War I. They did it again after World War II. Conservatives blamed the United States for allying with the Soviet Union against Nazi Germany. They were arguing that we should have, you know, been more hospitable to the Nazis. So that's my distinction.
I take your point, and I think it's an important distinction. And I think this is a very interesting book. I read it with great interest. The book is entitled America Last. The author is Jacob Heilbrunn. Some of the information about, let me describe it as the adulation of the South African regime was shocking, frankly, to me. And some of the adulation of Mussolini and Hitler, I didn't really know what to do with it. It was just head-shaking stuff. I wanted to ask you, because I probably knew some of this going into the book, but what were the surprises you took away from writing this book?
The one that really blew my mind was Senator Joseph McCarthy. Because he, after World War II, when he was elected to the Senate, seized upon the issue of Malmedy, Belgium, which was where SS officers and Nazi soldiers had executed in cold blood, I think close to 100 American soldiers who had surrendered. This was a war crime. There was an investigation and trial after World War II where these men were found guilty. However, the defense counsel was humiliated by the verdict. He's an American. And he claimed that these Nazi soldiers had been tortured by Jewish American prosecutors. McCarthy seizes upon this issue. And there was a subcommittee hearing in the Senate, and he was invited to attend. And he browbeats these Jewish prosecutors and claimed that they had kneed these Nazi soldiers in the groin, that they had crippled them. He used language, he called them 39ers because some of them had emigrated. It was a term for people who emigrated in 39, derogatory. He said, would you want to be prosecuted by a man with a name like Rosenberg? You know, it was blatant anti-Semitism. Now, this issue died off. I mean, it didn't work for McCarthy. You know, the Senate committee concluded that the War Department had conducted itself admirably. This is nonsense. But McCarthy was trying to whitewash Nazi war crimes. And he wasn't the only one. That's why I looked at the establishment of Regnery Press after World War II. What are the first books they start publishing? Books that set the stage for Holocaust denial in the United States. There's a woman named Frieda Utley who says that the United States committed war crimes that it were as bad or exceeded those of the Nazis. And then there are other books denouncing the establishment of Israel. So this is out there. In the late 40s, early 50s. Look, the conservatives never, it was fascinating to me, they never gave up. They defended Hitler before World War II, and then they argued that we should have allied with him to stop the Soviet Union. I mean, after World War II, they still maintained this argument. They never gave up. So that, to me, was quite telling.
I was a volunteer in 1992 for George W. Bush's primary campaign against Pat Buchanan. I've never been a fan of Pat Buchanan's. Could you tell me, you include Pat Buchanan in the book. Talk about who is Pat Buchanan for those who don't know who he is.
Pat Buchanan was an advisor to Richard Nixon, and he was an advisor to Ronald Reagan as well. He was a newspaper man, and he also ran several times for the presidency, including in the primary against George H.W. Bush in 1992. And Buchanan is a repository of the grievances of the old right that I'm talking about. He's written books denouncing American entry, not only into World War I, but also into World War II.
So let me just repeat that. He has written books denouncing America's involvement in World War II. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's nuts.
He's also wrote a column in 1977 saying that Hitler was, quote, a soldier's soldier, unquote. He has repeatedly dismissed the idea of going after Nazi war criminals. This was one of his bugaboos in the 1980s. So again, you know, Buchanan seemed to be a perfect heir to this tradition. And, you know, he's proud of it. He says America first. He wrote an article in the National Interest after the Cold War ended in 1990 called America First, Second, and Third. So he is entirely consistent. There's no hypocrisy there. He's out in the open with it all. He also worships Franco, by the way. All of this was inherited from his father. So Buchanan, to me, is a pivotal forerunner for Donald Trump. He's a grievance politician. He doesn't have quite the brand salesman qualities that Trump does, but he airs all of these grievances. He denounces the globalists. He denounces intervention abroad. He denounces free trade. He set the stage for Donald Trump.
What are some of your takeaways from the book, and what do they mean for the world that we find ourselves in today?
We should be apprehensive, but not terrified. I don't believe that this is a winning message politically. If we air what Donald Trump intends to do with the federal government and with our alliances abroad, which is pull out of NATO, sever the alliances in Asia, Trump is a perfect repository of these old right grievances in foreign policy. I think he would lead us right back into the past. I think you have an economic depression. If you decapitate the FBI and the CIA, you're leaving yourself wide open for a terrorist attack in the United States. So I think this is catastrophic. But is it appealing to the majority of Americans who believe in our democracy and, above all, the rule of law, which Trump wants to trash? I don't believe it. I think we need to be alert and vigilant, but forewarned is forearmed. That's why I wrote the book.
Jacob, tell me about the reception you've got. I know you're doing lots of conversations like this, and I encourage people to go out and read it. America Last, Jacob Heilbrunn. So any parting thoughts, Jacob?
Well, it was interesting to me when I went on C-SPAN, a lot of the callers were pro-Trump, but they reacted in a vitriolic manner, calling me a liar and a deceiver. And I said, look, you don't have to agree with my conclusions, but at least consider the evidence. I have not concocted some fairy tale. I went into the archives as much as possible. I went through numerous editions of not only the New York Times and Washington Post and Mencken's Baltimore Sun writings from 1914 onwards, but I also went through hundreds of books, and I tried to research this as assiduously as possible. And to me, look, I was astonished by what I found myself. I never would have dreamed that there would be this much evidence. And a British reviewer whose review I just got called it a horror show. And that's really what it is. It's the dark side of America, but we don't need to succumb to it. I remain an optimist.
Jacob, thanks. I too remain an optimist. This was really interesting. I thought it was a very well-researched book. I learned a lot. It was eye-opening, and I too remain an optimist. So Jacob, thanks for the time. Thanks for writing the book. And I'm really glad you came on our show today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog